You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, science writer Carl Zimmer is with us to give us the latest answers to the question, what is life? Take a tour of the cutting edge of biology, from viruses in nature to lifelike substances created in labs. Now, restaurants may be catching a break after a crushing year of closures, lost jobs, and lost income. More than 2 million food industry jobs have been lost because of the pandemic. Last week, President Biden signed a $1.9 trillion stimulus package into law that includes $28.6 billion for struggling bars and restaurants. And restaurant workers in Wisconsin recently became eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. We're checking in on the food industry after the most difficult year in generations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a restaurant or restaurants, or do you own a restaurant? What has this last year been like for you? How do you feel now that you'll be able to get vaccinated if you are a restaurant customer? Have you been willing to go into a restaurant? Have you done a lot of takeout, eaten outdoors? What would it take to get you back inside at the booth? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Layla Brukium is the owner of Layla's Downstairs Deli in downtown Madison and co-founder of the Culinary Ladies Collective, a professional network of women in the food industry. Layla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've closed one restaurant and reopened another one over the last year, I understand. Can you talk about how the pandemic has affected life as somebody running a restaurant?
It's been a wild ride, and it feels like we're almost at the end of something in some ways, even though, you know, you look at the numbers and there's still, people are still suffering, this still exists, this is not over. But things are changing, of course, and they have kind of been changing rapidly the whole time for us people in the restaurant. So now, you know, most recently we're able to bring in a few more people. Our capacities have changed and we're getting vaccinated. So, things are looking up, which is good.
Can you talk about how, I mean, restaurants all over the place, if they could, tried to adapt as much to, pick up and carry out, even if they didn't do that much before? How, for you and for the people you work with in the collective, what was that transition like?
Horrible. Mm-hmm. Is that being too honest, maybe?
No, that's...
You know, going from having an idea in your head of this is what I want my restaurant to look like, this is what I want my establishment to look like, you're pretty much asking restaurants to turn into fast food establishments, which maybe, you know, that's another topic altogether, is a fast food restaurant a restaurant. But, you know, you have to rewrite your menu, you have to rewrite your policies, you have to redo everything all very fast, or you're going to become irrelevant and have to close your doors. So
we had the PPP funding from the government that was supposed to help with payroll. Now we've got this new assistance that's in the pipeline anyway. What did that first thing mean for you, if anything? And do you think you'll be helped by this new federal money?
So I am finally getting PPP after an entire year. So I'm still kind of, you know, in the backlog of people on that one. I'm not exactly sure, and I don't know how many people in my industry are sure of what's the next step and what's coming up next with these new rounds of funding, what it's going to mean, because a lot of the programs that have come out, they say one thing and then they sort of turn into something else, which hasn't necessarily been bad, but it's just, you know, the first round of PPP, for instance, it was supposed to be for payroll. So people like me who are sole proprietors, micro restaurants, if you will, we weren't eligible because we didn't have huge payrolls. Well, then it sort of, you know, evolved into this new program. It's still the same program, but it's just being allocated differently so that some of us are eligible who weren't before. And it was a loan to begin with, which at the time, you know, if you're being offered a loan as a small business, you really want to take a side eye to that and think about it long and hard before you want to take on any more debt, especially when you're being told, well, you might not be open for a couple months. So I think I want to stay optimistic about it, though. And, you know, I think from what I've read, there's going to be some good things happening. Unfortunately, I think for some, it's going to be too late and their doors have already closed. So that's very disheartening and sad, but, you know, people can always come back in some other capacity. So we'll see what happens.
And Layla, before I let you go, restaurants can be a tough business even without a pandemic and, to run or to work in. Are there changes you're hoping to see maybe now that people are rethinking how restaurants do business?
Yes. I mean, I hope that the whole industry becomes very different than from what it was. I think that we're going to have kind of a split of restaurants that sort of survived because they kept doing the same thing or had already established themselves as kind of this whole, I like to refer to it as the matrix of food that you were plugged in and people go in and they type into their phone something that they feel like eating and they go and they pick it up and eat it at their houses or their cars, and it's kind of sad. and then there's this other factor that hasn't been around for a while where you get to call up your friends and say, hey, do you want to meet me at this place? I hear that they have this really good new item or this really good thing that I've had a million times and I really want to, show it to somebody new or, break bread with your friends, that kind of thing. So I think we've been missing this huge social component to restaurants that really, I think, is the heart of the restaurant industry and why it's good to see that people are caring that the Biden administration is pumping money back into us so that we continue to offer that to our society and have that in our society.
You really want to see people eating your food in your restaurant, don't you? That's going to be a great moment when that can just be like a normal thing, right?
Yep. Talking to each other and laughing and falling in love. I mean, that's, you don't fall in love in a McDonald's. You fall in love in a little weird place and with ambiance and, something to it, some depth to it. So hopefully that comes back.
Layla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good one.
That's Layla Brukium, owner of Layla's Downstairs Deli in downtown Madison, co-founder of the Culinary Ladies Collective. We are talking about restaurants during and hopefully soon after the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Christine Hilmer joins us now, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard from one particular restaurant owner there. Christine, as you look across the state, are you feeling at all hopeful now? Pandemic hopefully drawing to a close, federal money coming in, vaccines?
I have to say that I'm feeling much more optimistic today than I was even 2 weeks ago. The fact that we are eligible for vaccines. In fact, I know a number of restaurant workers who have gotten their first shot. That is a glimmer of hope that is we're so looking forward to a time when more people are vaccinated and there's more adoption and herd immunity and so on. We can open up. But the financial component of having $28.6 billion available to our restaurateurs is going to be huge. I will, though, make a caveat that $28.6 billion may seem like a lot of money. However, when you understand that there was about $240 billion lost in restaurants in 2020, that money is going to be spread thin and it's going to go fast.
Yeah, not to put a dark cloud on the silver lining here, but this is going to be too late for a lot of restaurants, right? I mean, do you have a sense of how many restaurants have decided, okay, this is the time to call it quits over this last year?
You are absolutely right. We know that there's a lot of folks who have quietly closed their businesses. They didn't go bankrupt. They basically just shuttered their doors and they walked away. So having a hard and fast number is very difficult. We won't really get a handle on it until towards the end of June when business licenses and liquor licenses are renewed. Our best guess at this time is 10 to 15% of restaurants have already gone out of business, with an additional 20 to 30 who are considering closing. Now, with vaccines and with this federal stimulus dollars on the horizon, some of those folks may rethink that. But we also know that with the federal government, things are never easy, and it's going to take a while to get that money out in the public. We know in December, with the CARES Act that was signed then, there was a pot of money set aside for shuttered stages and places that do performances. Well, unfortunately, they still haven't seen an application for those venues out yet. So restaurants are going to have to hang on perhaps another 2 months before they're going to have access to these funds. So we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Christine Hilmer is with us, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. We're looking at the restaurant business in Wisconsin, how it's dealt with the impact of the pandemic and some signs of hope now with some federal relief and vaccines. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a restaurant customer, when will you feel comfortable going back to a restaurant in person again? Have you been doing it already? Did you dine outside as much as you could before winter hit? Are you looking to get back out there? And if you work at a restaurant or you run a restaurant, I'd love to hear your perspective, how things have been going for you. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from a bunch of you on Facebook. Gabe wrote, going out to eat is definitely one of the things, if not the thing, I have missed the most. Well, how about you? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Wisconsin Restaurant Association CEO Christine Hilmer. We're looking at how the past year has been for Wisconsin restaurants and how vaccinations and government funding on the way may help them move slowly back toward normal times. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences as a restaurant worker, owner, or customer. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us calling from Madison. Jack, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jack?
Well, just wanted to say that I've been really fortunate to go out to eat here in Madison, and there are a bunch of spots that I'm really looking forward to eating at again. And it's just really weird because as much as I am looking forward to going back to eating in person, you know, I'm really apprehensive still about the atmosphere. And even though I'm not vaccinated yet, I'm just not sure. But it's just really, like, we're lucky in that we have one of the best local restaurant scenes in the country, and we really care about, like, the quality of food we put into that. So it makes sense that we're taking it nice and slow as we're getting back there. But I guess, at what point do you see most people feeling safe when it comes to returning to eating out normally, if that's not a loaded question?
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. It's a question a lot of customers are asking. And Christine, I'm sure that's on the minds of restaurant owners across the state. When are people going to feel comfortable?
It's going to take a long time. We know that late fall, the Marquette Law poll did a poll, the Marquette Law Center, that 50% of people were not comfortable eating out in a restaurant. And it's going to take a while to rebuild that faith that they are going to be able to come out to eat. I think that having vaccines in arms is going to go a whole long way for that. Also, the transmission rate and the rate of COVID in the community is going to be a big factor in it as well. So the good news is that weather is going to get warmer. We've got a little snow out here right now, but outside dining is going to be coming back. And I think that also is going to be a real boost in the arm for a restaurant to have that ability to do outside dining. I think people are going to be a little more apt to do outside dining than go inside, at least in the near future.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jack, at 800-642-1234. As I mentioned, we've heard from a bunch of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Brandy, who says one restaurant in Milwaukee decreased their capacity, but then sat all of the diners in the same corner of the dining room. We weren't spread out at all. Felt very uncomfortable. Other places took it more seriously. We ended up eating at places like that quite a bit. Mostly we get takeout. We've been ordering often to support the restaurants. That's a win-win. They get our business, and I don't have to cook. But you have, I know, guidelines and advice for Christine for restaurants operating at limited capacity. What kind of resources do you have? What kind of things do you tell restaurants as they're opening, again, not full on 100% capacity?
So we have always advised restaurants to follow the CDC guidelines, and they have changed, and they've morphed a little bit along the way as we've learn more about the virus. But we have always advised everybody to follow the guidance. And it's a lot of the very similar things that people know, that it's about wearing a mask. It's distancing the tables. It's about if you get up to walk around that you should be wearing a mask. And it's about just staying with your group. So we've always advocated for that. We also advise our members on the hypersanitization and different things that they can do within their restaurant so that they can make sure that they visibly show consumers that it's safe to go out to eat. That goes a really long way. It's going to take a little bit. Dane County has got probably the most restrictions out of the entire state, but the city of Milwaukee has some as well. There's other parts of the states that don't necessarily have as many restrictions. What I advise anybody, if they're uncomfortable or they're not sure, to go to the website of the restaurant to find out what protocols they are advising in their restaurant and so on. And if anything, if you want to call and you can find out what are they doing. And if it's just not for you yet, you can always do curbside. You can do delivery with a caveat, which we'll get to later. But you can always try to find out what they're doing within their facilities. It's going to take a little while to unwind this, but hopefully with more vaccines and with warmer weather, that things are definitely going to be improving.
And you mentioned that delivery caveat. What is that?
Yes. So we understand that there's lots of different ways to get restaurant quality food. A lot of people, and this is a trend pre-COVID, was to have restaurant quality food in your home. And you can do that either through a drive-through or through curbside delivery or curbside pickup and then delivery. But my advice to anybody, if you truly want to support a restaurant, is contact the restaurant directly to find out how to get their food delivery. There is a valid place for third-party deliveries, but unfortunately, there is a practice that is really unfortunate that happens a lot of times, and that's where a third-party delivery might take a menu from a restaurant and put it on their app and not have a relationship with that restaurant. And so it may be an incorrect menu. So the restaurant may not have all the ingredients to make what you want. Or if there's a question on the order, the restaurant can't go back directly to the customer and find out, you know, okay, we don't have this ingredient. Would you like this instead? They can't make any clarifications. And then the fees are also involved in it. So delivery is not inherently bad. But if it's done through the restaurant, who, pun intended, is in the driver's seat, that's the best way to support restaurants while also getting that delicious restaurant quality food at home.
So just to be clear, like that restaurant delivery service, if you're not going to the restaurant, could just be like me. And I say, yeah, I'll deliver you food from these five restaurants. And then you call the order to me. I call it there and just put a surcharge on it.
That happens.
It's a weird business
all
model.
The time. And with a lot of different ones. And there are some that are better than the other and so on. And I think that there is a space for third-party delivery, but only when there is a relationship between the restaurant and the third-party delivery is that acceptable. The restaurant needs to be able to be in control of how their food is delivered, making sure that it's safely done, that it's at temp, and they are in control over the pricing of it.
We are talking about restaurants in Wisconsin, how they are doing after a year of pandemic, and with some good news on the way, vaccines for restaurant workers, some federal aid in the pipeline. Christine Hilmer with us from the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Heard from a lot of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel writes, my wife and I have been fortunate to have received our two doses of vaccine. Great. And Joel says, I feel reasonably comfortable dining out now. And Christine, just anecdotally, I'm sure there's no data on this yet because the vaccines are still rolling out. Is that something you're hearing now? People fully vaccinated, ready to hit the restaurant?
Absolutely. I'm hearing from a number of our members who are saying that they're definitely seeing an uptick in sales. But they're still not out of the woods. You have to remember that they've gone through an entire year, part of it of which no indoor dining was allowed at all. And so they've got a steep hill to climb to recover. The best guesses we have through national data is that restaurants are likely to not fully recover until 2023 or 2024, which is pretty astounding.
Can you talk about how many jobs are involved in restaurants here in Wisconsin, roughly?
Absolutely. So, and these are pre-COVID numbers. So the restaurant industry represented to about $10.7 billion in sales, with almost 281 1,000 restaurant and food service jobs. It's 9% of the employment in the state. So when you consider that that kind of a sector in the state was closed down or is only able to be able to open partially, a lot of the folks that are still on unemployment are from our industry, unfortunately.
I see stories sometimes in the paper, Christine, of people in recent months actually starting new restaurants and obviously working that curbside model or delivery right in from the outset. Are you seeing much of that activity?
We're starting to see it. In fact, I do know of a couple that actually were in process and they did open during the pandemic. But now actually isn't such a bad time to get your ducks in a row and get your business model set, because I truly believe that there is going to be a pent-up demand. And you've mentioned it a couple times through the comments on your Facebook page. There's a pent-up demand. People want to get out. People want that social interaction. People really miss it. And I think that once there's greater adoption of the vaccines, more shots in arms, and the rates continue to be low, things are going to open up. And I think you're going to see second half of the year where a lot of people are going to just want to get out and not necessarily be stuck in their own four walls. They want to go to restaurants. They want to go to bars. They want to go to shows, and they want to see their friends.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Christine Hilmer, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. She joined us for a look at how restaurants have been doing over the last year and what the future may hold. We heard earlier from Layla Brukim from Layla's Downstairs Deli in Madison. And there's still time for you over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your restaurant, if that's the restaurant you own or manage or work at or love to go to. Are you feeling closer to comfortable to in-restaurant dining? Have you been doing a lot of takeout over this last year? Are you part of that pent-up demand our guest was talking about? You really have a hankering to get out to a restaurant when you feel safe doing so. And when will you feel safe doing so? Again, that's over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think. Coming up, we join a science writer's quest for a definition of what it means to be alive. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, I'm alive, you're alive, I think we can agree on that, but how do we know? And how important is it that we know that we're alive? The question of what it means to be alive, that answer can have a lot of legal, ethical, and other implications. Our next guest explored that question in some of the gray areas with a tour of the cutting edge of biology, from viruses in the wild to lab-grown neurons. He even evolved his own bacteria along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how we define life and some of the fuzzy areas around the fringe? What does it mean to you to say that something is alive? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Carl Zimmer is a science journalist and author of the New York Times column Matter. He's been a contributor to The Atlantic, National Geographic, Time, and Scientific American. Carl's written more than a dozen books about science, and his latest is called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think we have this sort of ballpark notion, all of us, Carl, of what life is. But when you start to look on the fuzzy gray areas, as you spent a lot of time doing in this book, it turns out we don't have such a cut and dried definition. Why is it so difficult to say this is life and this is not?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we think it should be easy. You just said that you're alive. You don't have scientific proof of it, but you have this feeling that you are, and you're pretty much trusting that I'm alive as well. I'm not some zombie talking to you. So we have these sort of almost biological intuitions of life. But then when we get to know these things that we call life at the molecular level, they get actually almost more puzzling the closer we look at them. And any definition that scientists come up with, it's pretty easy to find exceptions that defy their rule or paradoxes. And so scientists keep coming up with new definitions. There are literally hundreds of definitions that and more are added each year. A couple scientists I quote in the book Life's Edge say that there are as many definitions of life as there are scientists trying to define it.
And one answer to that question is to stop trying. You quote somebody, a medical researcher and ethicist, who says, you know, we're wasting our time trying to define life. Doesn't sound like that has a big reception in the biological community, though.
It certainly hasn't stopped people from trying to define life. I mean, those definitions keep on coming, but there are people, including some philosophers, who argue that we're really just barking up the wrong tree. Think about it. If it was 1500 and you went up to an alchemist and said, what's the definition of water? Well, if you look at alchemy books and writings at the time, you could guess that they would say, well, water is a substance that is transparent and is liquid and is tasteless. You know, they would give you a series of descriptions. And then you might say, like, okay, with the water gets cold and there's this stuff called ice, is that water? They say, like, well, no, because it's not liquid, it's different. So really what you would want to do is you'd want to wait 300 years until you had chemists that you could talk to, and they'd say, well, let me tell you about atoms and molecules and elements. And then we can actually talk about water in a meaningful way. So, you know, we're kind of in the age of alchemy when it comes to life.
Well, let's look at some of these interesting gray areas that you started to look at. And one, and I found this fascinating, you went and visited labs where, correct me if I have this wrong, because it seems pretty weird, they're taking what skin cells from humans, converting them to neurons, and then sort of growing clusters of human-like neurons. What's happening there? And is that life?
Well, these things are called brain organoids. You described the process quite well, that you can, you know, we can take a skin cell from you and scientists can put it in a dish, hit it with some chemicals. It will be transformed into a kind of a neuron that you would find in the head of a human embryo, and that will divide and multiply into hundreds of thousands, millions of neurons, which are all clustered together. It looks like a little pea, and they form a network like your brain. It forms little layers, like in the layers in your brain of your cortex, and they have electrical activity. They do things that look a lot like brain waves. So, you know, the scientists are actually like doing this in order to understand diseases like, you know, viral infections that affect the brains of embryos like Zika, or disorders like autism. And so they have like basic medical reasons they want to do this, but it does raise these really profound questions, like what are these things, and would we call them alive? They really do raise that question, you know, when does life begin for us humans? I mean, some people say, oh, it begins when you have a fertilized egg, or it's when something starts to develop, or, you know, sometimes we think of the brain as being the key to human life. So here we have these things that are becoming more and more human-like. There's metabolism going on inside of them. There's activity going on inside of them. They're very much alive. Are they human life? Like, it really kind of breaks the brains of philosophers at this point.
We're talking to Carl Zimmer about his new book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Well, of course, viruses, a big topic this last year, Carl. And by most definitions, they're not alive, as I understand it. Why not?
It really depends on who you're talking to. One recent morning, I got an email from a scientist telling me, viruses, of course, are not alive, and any expert will tell you that. And then that afternoon, I got an email from someone that afternoon saying, viruses, of course, are alive, and any expert will tell you that. So there you go. That kind of gives you a sense of where we stand with life and with viruses. But the debate has been going on long before the discovery of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that caused the COVID-19 pandemic. Basically, as soon as scientists started to figure out the molecular nature of viruses, there was kind of a big uh-oh, because they can replicate, which is a big thing that we think that life is able to do. They can evolve. You know, SARS-CoV-2 evolved to become a human virus, and it's evolving right now to get better at it as we see these variants spread around. So they're really good at evolving. So you've got those two things, but they don't eat. They don't grow. They have no metabolism. These viruses go into a cell and essentially take it over. And the cell makes new viruses. So for some people, that's it. That's where it stops. They cannot be considered alive. Other people say, well, wait a minute. That cell itself has become a virus factory. So the virus and the cell merge into a living thing. This debate is nowhere near ending, but it's fascinating because it really does make you think carefully about, well, what are these things that we share the planet with, these viruses? I mean, there might be a trillion species of viruses, and we still can't settle on this fundamental question about them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Couderay. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Daryl?
Well, my comment is, the question of the hour is, what is life, right? Well, life is water, or none of us would be here, and no viruses would be here. It'd be like the moon.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. And Carl, I think you quote a scientist who says that like life is something like a process of managing water. I'm getting the quote wrong, but something to that effect.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So it was a Nobel Prize winner named Albert Szent-Györgyi, a Hungarian biochemist who discovered vitamin C. I write about him a lot in the book. He's this amazing character. He made some incredibly important discoveries about the fundamental natures of life in World War II while he was actually a spy trying to get Hungary and the Allies together against the Nazis. Unbelievable life. Yeah. An amazing person. And he once playfully said that life is a play of water. In other words, that it's true that water is incredibly important to the chemical reactions that on which life as we know it depends. That's absolutely true. But that's as life as we know it. Is that a requirement of life? I mean, could there be some other solvent that organic molecules or living molecules could exist in? It's possible. Some people have speculated on that. What about, ethane or something like that on some moon around Saturn? It's a possibility. And another thing that I'll bring up is that, even if we look at water as being really important to life, I write about some amazing animals called tardigrades.
Oh, yeah.
In the book. They're sometimes nicknamed water bears or moss piglets. They're these tiny little animals. You can see they're all over the place in the forests and the oceans. And if you have a microscope, you can see them. Every now and then they face the all sorts of kinds of different stresses, such as dehydration. And so the water starts to leave their cells. Now, if you were dehydrated, you'd die. Actually, it wouldn't take very much water loss for you to keel over. But these tardigrades, they're fine, because what they do is they replace the water molecules with a special kind of sugar that functions like water, but doesn't evaporate. And then they also build proteins that are sort of like glass, and they basically encase all their DNA inside their cells and all the other proteins they need in these glassy proteins. And so they basically turn themselves into glass. There's no water left in them. They're frozen. There's no reactions that happen inside their bodies. So by, you know, by some definitions, they should be considered dead. They're not alive. But scientists say they refer to this as a third state. And they can come out of it if you just give them some water. In fact, they can survive this way for 30, 40 years and then pop right back into going about their business, crawling around as if nothing had happened. So, you know, we can make these blanket rules, but you better watch out that nature may have found something that completely turns it upside down.
Thanks for the call, Daryl. We're talking to science writer Carl Zimmer about his new book. It's called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the latest research into life, what it is, maybe how it came to be in the first place? We'll maybe check in on that in just a bit. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about some of the history of the search for a definition of life. Carl Zimmer is with us. His new book is called Life's Edge. You can join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234. Carl, I want to talk about the origins of life. Still big questions about what conditions needed to be there, maybe in the earth as it was a long time ago. And people are going, you found out, to the tops of volcanoes into the bottoms of the ocean to try to figure this out. What do we know?
Well, there's a lot more that we now know than a few decades ago when there were the classic experiments where scientists would just put a little spark into a broth and watch chemicals form there. The experiments that scientists have been doing have gotten much more elaborate and give us a sense of how the building blocks that might have been present on the early Earth could have come together into protocells with genetic building blocks and then eventually evolve into life as we know it. Chances are that it probably started in a very simple form, like an oily bubble that had a little bit of RNA in it. You know, that may sound like a Moderna vaccine, and in a way it kind of was, that, you know, you basically had this molecule that could do a lot of sort of primitive tasks of storing genetic information and also carrying out chemical reactions. But where that came about is a subject of big debate. I focus on one scientist named David Deamer, who for decades has argued that, the ponds that formed on new volcanic islands billions of years ago on the early Earth would have been the perfect place for this chemistry to get going. Now, there are other people who say, no, we got to look at the bottom of the ocean. We have to look at these chimneys where hot mineral-laced water is gushing out of the ocean floor and creating all sorts of crazy chemistry. And that's where life could have begun. They can't both be right. So it's going to be interesting to see how this debate plays out, and it's going to have big implications for, well, how could have life begun on other planets or moons as well?
Let's go back to our callers now. Sid is with us in Madison. Sid, hello.
Hi, thanks for being here. I was curious how you consider other cultural perspectives on what life is and what it means to be animate, and if that comes up in your research at all.
Sid, thanks for the call. And Carl, yeah, different cultures and different places through time might define life differently. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are cultures in which life or maybe animacy is not unique to, say, people, animals, and plants, but to everything on the planet. There are lots of different ideas about when life begins. When does a human life begin? There are, you know, some tribes who feel that children actually come from a sort of a land of the dead. For the first few days after birth, they're still really belong to that other world. And so so if there's an early death of a child, they look at that differently than maybe another culture would. They feel like, well, they're going back to the place where they really hadn't left yet. And yeah, so it's, you know, certainly like when we talk about what science has to tell us about life, we have to make sure that we're clear on what we're talking about with life in the first place, which can really, you know, in some cases be very much something that comes out of our different cultures, as opposed to being some sort of quote unquote objective, you know, nature of the world. And certainly, like, you know, that comes down to like debates about, you know, when life ends. Are we going to define life as, you know, if a body is still, you know, able to metabolize fuel and to keep a steady body temperature, is that still life? Or do we look at the brain as being essential to human life? You know, brain death is death, and according to our laws, why do we make that choice? I explore that in the book. I mean, that is a choice that emerged in the 1950s and 60s with the advent of technology that suddenly like made it possible to keep people alive even when their brain was not functioning.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sid. We're talking to Carl Zimmer about his new book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Well, Carl, I wanted to ask you, we've got this Perseverance rover on Mars. It's looking for signs of past life on the planet. Are we going to know, do you think, what life looks like? Could we conceivably encounter something that is alive in some sense? We just don't recognize it in that way?
Well, we should probably just have modest hopes in the sense that, like, let's hope that we find something kind of weird. And, you know, in other words, something that when you look at it, you're like, I don't think that like regular geology could have formed that. Maybe scientists will find molecules that are just kind of big and take a lot of steps to produce in if you tried to make them in a lab. That could be a sign of life. Or maybe organization, you know, in a fossil, maybe, you know, like maybe layers like you find in bacterial mats. That might be enough. We're not going to have a Martian just walk up to Perseverance and say, hi, I'm here. I'm glad you made it. It's going to be ambiguous. It could take a long time for us to really realize if life is actually staring us in the face.
What kind of research are you looking forward to now? What has you most excited when it comes to answering some of these questions about the frontiers of defining what life is?
I think there may be some scientists who may be able to make something like life pretty soon. And it may not really have anything to do with DNA and proteins. It may just be that like other chemicals can take on a sort of lifelike qualities, you know, and that'll be interesting. Like if they're kind of like life, but not quite, in a way that might tell us more about life than if we were just to sort of, you know, create bacteria, which we already know about. We know about bacteria. So if you make bacteria, okay, fine, whatever. but you know, like maybe there's something, you know, life might be a property of matter, the way superconductivity is. And it doesn't really depend on some particular set of elements, but it may just be something that emerges when certain conditions become right. But we need a theory to explain that, which we don't yet have. So, you know, I hope that we can live long enough to see that happen, but I can't say exactly when it will.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer is a science journalist and author of the Matter column for the New York Times. We've been talking to him about his latest book. It's called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive.